Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. First today, a history-defining moment in the British Parliament.
The ayes to the right, 330. The noes to the left, 275. The ayes have it, the ayes have it. And look!
And with that vote, a bill which would give those in England and Wales with terminal illnesses the right to legally end their own lives, what's known as assisted dying, moved a step closer to becoming law. The bill still faces weeks of further scrutiny with the possibility of further amendments, but if finally approved, it would give those aged over 18 with less than 6 months left to live the option of having a doctor prescribe them lethal drugs, but with a number of safeguards. MPs were under no pressure to vote along party lines in what's known as a free vote, and they did so by 330 to 275 to pass the bill. It had been proposed by Kim Leadbeater from the governing Labour Party, who acknowledged that the decision facing MPs was not straightforward.
I know that this is not easy. It certainly hasn't been easy for me. But if any of us wanted an easy life, I'm afraid we're in the wrong place.
She argued the current system was failing, leaving families in impossible positions as they care for terminally ill relatives and robbing those who are sick of choice.
Any one of us or our loved ones could be unfortunate or unlucky enough to receive a terminal diagnosis. And I struggle to see how it is fair or just to deny anyone the autonomy, dignity and personal choice that we might want to take control of our final weeks. And the right to choose does not take away the right not to choose. Yeah. Giving the choice of an assisted death to those who want it would, of course, not stop anyone who is terminally ill from choosing not to do so.
But Mary Kelly Foy, another Labour MP, opposed the bill. Her concerns centred on her experience with her daughter Maria, who was born with a number of health conditions.
We were told many times that she might have only 6 months to live. She lived for 27 years. Crucially, Maria was non-verbal. And I am filled with dread and fear for those other people like Maria who are non-verbal and don't have that capacity, and what might happen to others like Maria if they aren't loved and cared for and have somebody speaking out for them.
Mary Kelly Foy, Member of Parliament of Britain's governing Labour Party. And let's hear now from the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason, who describes a very unusual day of highly charged debate in Parliament.
It has felt like Parliament at its expansive, thoughtful, passionate best. You know, the nature of parliamentary party politics is most debates here, to state the obvious, are looked at through the prism of party politics, loyalty and ideology and the spectrum of left and right, etc., etc. And, you know, that can lead to a certain sense of jadedness from some about the kind of political debate that we hear. But it is a necessary organising tool, isn't it, for governments and opposition parties to try and bind themselves together. But for those of that cynical disposition, today is a day to take another look, because a very, very different tone of debate, a visceral and direct conversation about life and death, as one MP put it. We've heard testimony about the most horrible deaths, told in respectful silence, often from those demanding a change in the law. There is then the power of the case about the role of the state. Should the state become a suicide service, as one described it, in opposition to this change? And then you have that strength of conviction articulated by some, others who are deeply conflicted, and several who have been unable to hold themselves together in making their contribution, such as the emotional tug, often sharing tissues with one another when they've finished their contribution, an arm around an MP in solace after a contribution has been made. So it's a tone and tenor of debate that you so rarely see and hear here.
That was our political editor, Chris Mason. So what's changed since MPs last voted on and indeed rejected by almost the same number of votes the legalisation of assisted dying in 2015? I've been speaking to historian Sir Anthony Seldon and Professor Dame Claire Gerada, former president of the Royal College of GPs, or General Practitioners. Clearly, the composition of Parliament has changed since last time, but first, does Sir Anthony believe there's also been a societal change?
Well, I think there has to be, doesn't there? Because 73%, if the polls are to be believed, of British people are in favour of this bill. And that's very different to 9 years ago when this came before Parliament and when only 119 MPs voted for it. So I think it's a change of MPs, it's a change in society, and it's also been an issue that has been championed by a very, very powerful British figure with 40 years of hold on television, a kind of British Oprah Winfrey, Esther Ransom, and she has been again and again passionately speaking in favour of this legislation.
So you're suggesting that a single woman has been responsible for this change in society?
I think that I think that this is the power of democracy. I think that often these single issue figures, one person coming out articulating a case very strongly. I mean, there are very few people in this country, in Britain, who have that popular hold over the imagination. And she's a very articulate woman. She's been in everyone's living rooms in Britain for many, many years. So I think that that was a factor. I think societal changes, there's been a move away from religion in some ways. Some religions have been growing. I think that's a factor. It feels like an issue whose time has come.
Okay, well, let's bring in Professor Dame Claire Gerarda. And you heard Sir Anthony there, and I was just wondering whether the kind of societal change that he was talking about over, just the past nearly decade, whether that is reflected in doctors' attitudes as well?
Well, I mean, good evening. I mean, I was head of my profession in 2012, and we debated this. And at the time, I wanted my Royal College of GPs to hold a neutral stance rather than to be opposed to assisted dying. And at the time, the public was very in favour. I mean, it was the same sort of figures as we've got now. About two-thirds of the public, if not three-quarters, when you surveyed them, were in favour of assisted dying. But what happened then was most of the Royal Colleges, certainly the major Royal Colleges, held a view against assisted dying. They've now gone, the majority of them, to a neutral view. In other words, as a collective, doctors shouldn't have any more sway in this debate than the man on the proverbial Clapham omnibus, which is quite right, because when you actually look at doctors, their views are the same as the general public. So I think what's happened, I take Anthony's point that a single figure like Esther Ransom has swayed some views, but I think it's been more that actually, for my own profession, they've held back. They've said it's not for us to sway this vote anymore. My view as an individual is the same as somebody else's. It's just as important. But as a collective, I shouldn't be trumping the views of the public. And that's why I think today was historic, because politicians, MPs, as you heard, did what they have to do on our behalf, which is to make very difficult decisions.
Okay, so you say doctors have chosen to hold back, but does the outcome of this vote now put them in the hot seat?
Well, yes, of course it does. And as it does with lawyers, of course, but as we go through, as the bill goes through, that the guardrails around this, what does it mean? We know that it's got to be two doctors and a High Court judge, probably, but what does it actually mean? How are we going to assess eligibility? But I think we slightly overestimate what the hot seat means, because the hot seat is for the patient to take the drugs. We're not administering them. It's not that somebody is putting up an intravenous line and injecting drugs into them. What doctors are going to do, which is what I've done for 40 years, is to sit with my patient and their families and help them make some very difficult decisions. And up till now, it's not been life and death decisions, but very difficult decisions. Should I have a major operation? Should I have a termination of pregnancy? So we have to carry on doing that. But in the end, as I see the legislation, it's going to be doctor-assisted dying. In other words, the patient will take the drug, not the doctor administering the drug.
Sir Anthony, how far have we got to go before and if this bill becomes law?
Well, I think the if is important to stress, and it is going to can take up to 2 years. There's going to now be the committee stage. There will be a lot of amendments. There's very strong feelings. Those who were beaten today will come back. They'll talk to their own medical advisors and supporters and come up with all kinds of difficulties. It's hard to get a private member's bill into law. Not impossible, obviously, but it's hard. So there's going to be a prolonged battle which could last, a very long time and eat up a lot of parliamentary time and be a significant distraction. But that's what the power of these issues do. It's hard to think of any issue that's been as an issue of conscience, a moral issue that's been as prolonged as this issue in Britain, but in many other countries as well. And this has got a long way to run before it becomes law and before it becomes generally accepted.
Professor, just a quick intervention from you, very, very briefly. I mean, I was just wondering, I think about doctors being in the hot seat as a result of the outcome of this bill, but are they in that hot seat most days? Are they taking these kinds of decisions, though not explicitly?
Yes and no. I mean, in the old days, when I was a younger doctor, a younger GP, we would make these decisions. We did certainly not assist death, but we certainly would put up drips that might contain medicines that would accelerate patients' death, people right at the end of their life. Now we've gone 45 years on since I qualified, and actually the system really does the complete opposite. It's over-medicalising end of life. The number of times patients in their 90s are admitted as emergencies into hospital who die on a hospital A&E trolley because there's been no end of life directive.
Well, that was Professor Dame Claire Gerada, former president of the Royal College of GPs, or General Practitioners, here in the UK. We also heard from historian Sir Anthony Seldon. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up in 5 minutes, we'll hear from one of the artisans involved in restoring Notre Dame Cathedral.
The cathedral now, it looks just fantastic, like it did 800 years ago. So for anyone who's going to come to visit it, they'll be completely astonished. It's just, I have no words to describe it. It's like, you have to come and see it.
And the latest headlines from the BBC newsroom reports say Islamist rebels have now taken several neighbourhoods of Syria's second city, Aleppo, on the third day of their lightning offensive. And Georgian police have deployed tear gas and water cannon against thousands of anti-government protesters gathered in the capital for a second night. We'll have more details of both those stories later in this edition of NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. And we go now to Syria. And 8 years after they were bombed out of the country's second city of Aleppo by Syrian and Russian planes, rebels opposed to the government of President Assad are back. Well, the jihadi-led rebels are reported to have taken control of 5 neighbourhoods of Aleppo, having cleared the way with 2 suicide car bomb attacks. They launched their surprise offensive on the city on Wednesday. The Syrian authorities say reinforcements have arrived and are driving back the rebels, while Russia says it's bombing them. I've been speaking to Joshua Landis, director of the Centre of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. What's he been hearing from Aleppo?
A friend of mine who lives in New Aleppo and in the Christian quarters near the western side of Aleppo, where the rebels have entered, says that they came to his house and knocked on the door and said, please don't go outside. You'll be safe as long as you do this and that. And we don't want to hurt you, so forth. And they were taking over the streets and knocking on people's apartment doors. And they had moved into the neighborhood.
So literally just like that, walked in without meeting any resistance from either Syrian government or Russian forces.
Very little resistance, and the Syrian forces have fell pretty quickly. And this was mostly with machine guns and small arms fire and so forth. So why the government troops were not prepared for this, because there had been some discussion about a possible attack, is anybody's question. But it's very clear that the Syrian army lacks morale, and its forces have collapsed pretty easily in this area.
I mean, it was a surprise offensive, but it did begin last Wednesday. So they certainly had time to defend the city.
Yes, they did. And things had been picking up along the borders where since 2020, there has been a sort of a frozen conflict. And the rebels had been pushed up into Idlib province in northern Aleppo, where they had been stuck. And the Russians and the Turks had come to an agreement, which the Assad regime supported. And this is a major breakout. It's the first one in 4 years, and it really changes the balance of power in Syria. And it underlines how weakened the Syrian government has become. And this is, of course, something that Israel has been working on by pounding Syria since October 7th. The United States has tried to keep Syria as weak as possible because it's a major artery for weapons from Iran to get into Lebanon. But Netanyahu's offensive had the effect of weakening governments right across this whole region, and particularly the Syrian government. And it's clear that it seems clear that rebels are trying to exploit that weakened situation in order to advance their position.
The rebels, though, are a mixed bag, quite a broad alliance. Who are they, and will that alliance hold?
Well, the main rebel group is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and they are led by Abu Muhammad al-Jawlani. And now al-Jawlani, who rules Idlib province, and this militia, was a lieutenant of Caliph Baghdadi of ISIS. He was sent to Syria early in the civil war to form a militia that would be part of al-Qaeda. That was al-Nusra. He has shifted the name and shifted the contents of his militia, but he's the same guy who fought against Americans in Iraq, came to Syria, fought against the regime in Syria, was pushed into Idlib province, and now this offensive.
That was Joshua Landis, director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Let's cross to France now, where back in 2019, many people in the country, so proud of their heritage, gasped in shock as the Gothic Jewel, which is the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, was consumed in flames. At the time, 5.5 years ago, the president, Emmanuel Macron, declared that the 860-year-old cathedral would be rebuilt within 5 years and be restored to a glory not seen for centuries. Well, today, President Macron was able to see the results for himself. He was taken on a tour of the building and met some of the highly skilled craftsmen and women involved in the restoration, including the master carpenter, Damien Pinadi, who spoke to Newsar's Tim Franks from within the great cathedral.
Basically, I'm part of a group of traditional carpenters, and we were called to participate in this project because our skills with the axes. So basically, we transform logs into beams using only axes, different type of axes. And we're still using some traditional methods of carpentry.
So it's not just about the fact that you were trying to restore Notre Dame to its former magnificence, but that you were using traditional techniques to do so. I mean, techniques stretching back hundreds of years. What was the advantage of trying to work in that way?
Well, there's a lot of benefit using this technique. First, structurally sound is much, much, much resistant. It will be a carpentry that will last for a century, as they proved just before the fire. Also, using the axes, we are able to follow the shape of the tree, the original shape. For us, as an artisan, we get a connection with the material, much, much intimate. So all that energy, all that effort gets transmitted to every single beam that we touch. So the overall result is astonishing. It's beautiful and a lot more strong.
You say the overall result is astonishing. You have now been one of the privileged few who have seen inside the fully restored Notre Dame. What's it been like?
Oh, it just, as you say, is a privilege, is an honour, and I'm very lucky to be involved in this project. The cathedral now, it looks just fantastic, like it did 800 years ago. So for anyone who's going to come to visit it, they'll be completely astonished. It's just, I have no words to describe it. It's like, you have to come and see it.
All I can say is that just watching some of the pictures from the television feed, it does look amazing inside. It's remarkable that the French president, he set this very punishing timetable of getting it all done in 5 years, but he said he wanted Notre Dame to come back even more beautiful. And there is that, I mean, from what I've seen of the two-dimensional pictures, it looks, it's sort of shining in its magnificence.
It is, because I've been inside the cathedral before the fire, and it was all dusty, and it was a bit dark throughout the centuries, all the smoke from the candles and the pollution around the city, and now it's been clean, so it's all white and shiny. All the gold leaves are like shining through all the single bulbs there in the cathedral, so it's kind of a spectacular to walk in.
Yeah, and the fact that you and your colleagues, that you have this connection now with it in a very sort of visceral way. You, as you say, you haven't been just involved in reconstructing the body of the cathedral, but you've been doing so in a way that really connects you to the history of the construction of the cathedral.
Yes, so we have that kind of burden and responsibility, you know, to respect their work. I think we did it, and very well. And the community that grew, that was born throughout this process, it's just fantastic. I mean, all the people I met on site and on the workshop, they're just, we're all there with the same goal, just to get it done in time and having fun in the process.
That was Master Carpenter, French Master Carpenter, Damien Pinardi, speaking to the BBC's Tim Franks about his role in the restoration of the Cathedral of Notre Dame after that devastating fire back in 2019. And don't forget, if you want to listen to News Hour but miss the live broadcast, a podcast of the programme is available, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine BBC News Hour podcast and you'll find it there. You can also subscribe to the feed if you want to receive it on a regular basis. Do stay with us, a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes. You're listening to News Hour. Now, to what some argue is one of the sports stories of the year, 20-year-old Emmanuel Wanyonyi becoming the youngest men's 800 metres champion in Olympic history. It was an achievement all the more remarkable because of his extremely tough childhood. BBC Sport Africa's Kelvin Kamathi has been speaking to Emmanuel in Western Kenya.
Feeding cattle isn't easy work, even for an Olympic champion. But for Emmanuel Wanyonyi, it's part of who he is.
Looking after cattle as a child was tough, but I had to do it so I could eat. Sometimes I wasn't paid, but it gave me a place to sleep.
Born in Saboti village, Western Kenya, Wanyonyi was one of 11 children in a family struggling with poverty. At the age of 10, he dropped out of school to help provide for his loved ones.
When I got something small, I would take it home to my siblings so they could also have something to eat. It's the only reason I endured the job.
Wanyonyi sometimes earned less than $2 a month, and sometimes he was paid nothing at all.
There was a man I was working with. He was a police officer. He was very strict. He used to wake me up and tell me he wanted me to cut big trees and dig out the lower roots. I did it for 3 months. I built my house in iron sheets.
Aged 13, Wanyonyi returned home, and that's when he discovered his talent for running.
When I was training at one of the nearby school grounds, the teacher noticed me and told me I can run very well and get into athletics, but I will have to go back to school. When I came back to school, my dad was really happy. He would see me going to practice, and he loved that a lot.
Wanyonyi's father worked as a caretaker at a dam, but tragedy struck when he was found dead at the site in 2018, a day that lives long in Wanyonyi's mind.
My father was working, guarding water for someone to prevent people from destroying the pipes. He had never come to school before. I was in class, and he made sure I was called, and I went to the fence. He gave me about $2 and told me to go buy running shoes. It's like he was strangled and placed by the water. He was found with a mark on his head, as if he was hit. What I think happened is that he placed his clothes there to swim, and then someone came to rob him. I wish he was here to see me run. I would even push harder because of all the love he had for me.
And despite his father's death, Wanyonyi quickly rose through the athletics ranks on his way to gaining a place in the Kenyan national team. His coach, Claudio Beraldelli, continues to be impressed.
Something which is unique in Wanyonyi is his mental attitude. It's like he's fearless, probably because of his background. But what makes a champion to be a champion is the mental attitude, and he's a champion in his mind.
That's a report by BBC Sport Africa's Kelvin Kimathi. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Demonstrators out on the streets of the Georgian capital for a second day running, where they were met by riot police deploying tear gas and water cannon. They were protesting against the newly elected government's decision to delay European Union accession talks. The Georgian Dream government announced their decision just hours after the European Parliament adopted a non-binding resolution rejecting the results of Georgia's October elections, alleging significant irregularities and calling for a new vote under international supervision. Speaking to NewsHour, the European Parliament's permanent rapporteur for Georgia, Rasa Yuknavichna, explained why they took the action.
Recently, in European Parliament, adopted very strong resolution asking international community and also Georgia to rerun election because they were not fair and free. And we asked member states not to recognize those election and to stay away from this government, which, of course, will be not recognized.
Protesters accused the government of tilting towards Moscow, and more than 100 diplomats and civil servants have signed an open letter saying the government's decision does not align with Georgia's strategic interests. One demonstrator, Iraklia Abasadze, said the Georgian people would not give up their goal of EU membership.
Georgia has only one path, that is the fight to join the Western democratic world. Therefore, the aim and the tactic of the action is protest, 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 protest in all its forms. People can do it in the streets, at work, with strikes, individual protest. They have to feel that the government cannot rule the situation, derailing the country from the Western path and abolishing elections.
Georgian protester Irakle Abasadze. And about an hour ago, I spoke to the BBC's Rehan Dimitri, who was out on the streets of the capital, Tbilisi.
The protest is very much ongoing. There are lots of people on the Rustaveli Avenue. This is the main street that runs past the parliament. And I'm standing some 200 meters away from the parliament because it's impossible to get a mobile phone signal outside where there are lots and lots of protesters. So a short while ago, the riot police once again used water cannons to disperse the protesters, but some of the kind of die-hard protesters, they're trying to get through the gates of the parliament, and despite being sprayed with water, And earlier when I was outside the parliament, there were some angry scenes. You played this sound at the beginning now, the banging noise. And that is the noise that protesters beating on the metal fence, which was installed at the front entrance to the parliament. And they're doing it with a lot of anger, you know, trying to create a lot of noise. This is... now they're again booing and whistling. So their tactic right now, Julian, is to create a lot of noise.
Okay. No, Rehan, I don't place yourself in any danger, will you? But I was wondering what the protesters thought of that European Parliament non-binding resolution rejecting the results of the elections and calling for a new vote, what they thought of that, because it does seem to have precipitated this reaction from the government suspending accession talks, which is what the protesters didn't want to see.
Well, I think it was perhaps expected because Georgian people who have been protesting for many months now, and I would even say for years now, you know, saying, holding banners where they're saying Georgia is Europe. They have always looked up towards the European Union for help. And I don't know if you can hear it, Julian, so the crowd is chanting Rusebo, which means Russians, Russians. This is, of course, the reference towards their government, the Georgian dream. So regarding the resolution, I think it was expected, but yes, it's quite a strongly worded resolution, which also called for targeted sanctions against the country's prime minister, against the honorary chairman of the ruling party, Georgian Dream, the country's richest man, whom many here consider the main man behind the power. And earlier when I was outside parliament, some students, they held a big banner which said, chosen by the oligarch, not people. And this was the reference to those MPs who have made it to the parliament. And right now, there are only MPs from the Georgian Dream Party because the opposition is boycotting the parliament. They, in protest against what they say widespread violations during last month's parliamentary election.
It does sound, though, at the moment, is a bit of a stalemate, Rehan.
I think this was, this announcement by the government, this announcement that they're going to put EU accession talks on hold, I think it really touched the nerve for many, many Georgians, yeah. Because this is the nation that has repeatedly said in many opinion polls over the years, stating that more than 80% of the Georgian population wants to see their future in Europe. Yeah. They, frankly, don't really have a choice. You know, it's either Russia, which is their next door neighbor, or a more democratic and prosperous European future. And this is why people are standing here, because they believe, and they told me that this is their last chance to defend their country's democracy.
That was the BBC's Rehan Dimitri speaking from the streets of the Jordan capital, Tbilisi. Thursday saw another large-scale Russian attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, the second this month and the tenth this year. Millions of Ukrainians have had to put up with fresh waves of power cuts just as winter arrives and temperatures drop. Ukrainians are adapting and, in some cases, finding comedy in their predicament, but the energy situation is worse than ever. Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, has been given rare access to one of the country's damaged thermal power plants, which escaped the latest Russian barrage. He reports now on how Ukraine is bracing for another difficult winter.
These vast power stations have a way of making you feel very, very small. And it's the same with the damage, too. As I look down into the power plant, I can see tiny figures moving around, conducting repairs, removing damaged equipment, trying as best they can to keep up with this relentless assault on Ukraine's power grid.
In the huge turbine hall, there's wreckage everywhere and gaping holes in the roof. We've agreed not to name the plant, say when it was hit, or identify its employees. All information, we're told, that could help Russia to direct its next attacks. But the plant has been hit by drones and missiles many times. Oleksandr occupies a senior position here.
We can't keep up with the restoration work. We don't have time to restore the main equipment, let alone the roof and walls. Everything gets destroyed again, from one strike to the next.
So here on the ground, next to the damaged transformer, is a pile of jagged silver metal fragments. These, we're told, are from a missile that landed here not that long ago.
We find Dmytro taking a break in the control room. A veteran at the plant, he's been present for most of the attacks.
What's it like working in a place that is so constantly targeted?
Well, it's our job. First of all, if we don't work here, then who will? Some are defending the front lines on the battlefield. We have our own energy front to defend.
And while the engineers struggle to keep the lights on, Ukrainians do what they've done for 3 years now, cope. In the middle of the latest power cut, Natalia is warming up a pot of borscht on her portable gas cooker. She lives high up in an apartment block on the edge of Kyiv.
In a multi-story building, when there's no power, there is no water, no heating. Everything we use, everything normal people in the modern world rely on, none of that is available.
But with necessity comes cooperation and innovation. Down in the basement, I'm taken to see a brand new system that stores electricity and then kicks into action as soon as there's a power cut. It's expensive. The building's 700 residents club together to buy it. It helps pump water to the top floors and keeps the lift working. Very good news for Natalia up in her apartment on the 19th floor.
It's a very strange feeling. I'm happy I can go downstairs with my dog in the lift. I don't have to walk down in the dark, that I have water in the tap. It scares me just how happy I am to have these basic things.
Усі наші сусіди гарні люди. And dealing with basic things, it turns out, makes for great comedy. Against all the odds, Ukraine's film industry is still going. In a movie about to be released, art mirrors some of this war's more mundane struggles as a fractious group of residents bickers over the purchase of a generator. Ivan Melashenko is putting the final touches to the film with his director Mitya Shmurak. The storyline had its origins in the fevered conversations taking place in the group chat of Ivan's own apartment building.
It's like common to many Ukrainians right now to buy a generator, big generator for the apartment building to go through the winter. Of course, when people are starting to have these clashes, conflicts, of course we have all jokes you can imagine when the neighbors are trying to find the common ground.
Ivan calls the film a dramedy. It's certainly full of jokes, but there's a simple positive message too.
Of course, we wanted to underline and to raise and to show that, okay, everything is possible. We can do everything we need. We can go through this winter. The only thing we need is to unite. This is it.
That was Paul Adams with a report on the damage that Russia is inflicting on Ukraine's energy infrastructure. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. And And we return to the topic of assisted dying after the vote today in the British Parliament that makes it closer to becoming legal in England and Wales. It's an emotive issue both inside Parliament and within the country, and those both for and against the legislation gathered outside the building. Let's hear from a couple of them.
My father, Ian Douglas, took his own life in February 2019. He suffered from secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, and his was a very lonely and dangerous death, and a very good demonstration of why the current law is really not working. The bad death of a loved one scars you for the rest of your life. I lost my dad in incredibly traumatic circumstances, and I have to live with that. But today's bill allows dying people choice. It allows them to choose a safer, fairer, and more compassionate death.
My name's Edward. I've come with my wife today because we believe that the safeguards are not sufficient, and our fear is that it will be the beginning of a slippery slope, as has proved the case in Canada, where one in 24 deaths now is assisted.
Well, Canada is one of those countries that opponents of such legislation point to when they use that phrase, slippery slope. Assisted dying was legalised there in 2016 by the nation's Supreme Court. Recent plans to extend this service to those with psychological problems were put on pause. In April this year, the BBC spoke to a man living in Canada called John Scully. He suffers with severe depression, anxiety and PTSD, and he said he wanted to apply for a medically assisted death.
I take 30 pills a day, 30. That's to deal with other physical and mental problems. I've had 19 shock therapies. It did no good, but God knows what harm it did. I suffer from somatic pain, chronic pain. That means pain that they can't diagnose and assume it's psychiatric. I've been in this condition for roughly 40 years.
John Scully in Canada. Well, the Netherlands became the first country in the world to legalise assisted dying back in 2002. What is known as the Termination of Life on Request and Assisted Suicide Act had similar criteria to the bill passed today by the British Parliament, such as that the patient's request is voluntary and that their suffering is unbearable and will not improve. But how has the act been implemented over time? How has it evolved? And how many people have taken advantage of it? Theo Boer is a professor of medical ethics at Utrecht University in Netherlands. He also served on the country's euthanasia review committee between 2005 and 2014. He's been telling me about how the nation's 2002 bill came about.
A lot of thought went into it. We have a long history of debating this. We started in 1969 and we finally legalized it 30 somewhat years later. So we had a long discussion, and since 2002, when the law became effective, we have seen some important developments, but the law itself has not changed.
So who qualifies for assisted dying? Here in England, you have to be, and Wales, you have to be over 18.
Yes, well, nowadays there is no age requirement at all, because you could originally ask for euthanasia after reaching the age of 12, but that has now changed. That's incredibly young. And to 12 to 16, you have to have your admission, and you have to have the consent of your parents. And from 17 and 18, you have to inform your parents. That luckily, that doesn't happen all too often. The most groundbreaking change is that it is now also possible for children aged 0 to 11, and that is on the request of their parents.
And I also understand that there is discussion around allowing those over 75 to qualify for assisted dying, even though they may not have any mental or physical complaint.
Yes, that is totally correct. We'll discuss that in Parliament next week. I doubt whether there will be a majority for it. There was formerly, but there have been some important governmental reports that are advising against it. But it says that any person over 74 years old can get assistance in suicide, not euthanasia. It's not the doctor doing it, but they will get the deadly medication solely on the basis of age. You just need to be sure. So yeah, there's a waiting time of, I think, 3 months, and that would be it. I think it will be a very important decision next week.
I mean, it's a medical professional who helped in the creation of the original act. Do you feel that Netherlands has gone down a slippery slope here?
Well, the slippery slope, you know, actually, I do think so. By the way, I'm not a physician, but an ethics
professor. No, I
appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. But yes, of course, what the point is, I always say to Britain, there will be a discourse of justice. And that means that once you have legalized euthanasia or assistance in suicide for a certain group, in your case, it would be anyone who has a terminal disease and has no life expectancy longer than 6 months, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So I think there will be a justice discourse saying why is it only those people? Because some of the people that you have showed in your show earlier this evening, they have a longer life expectancy, and frankly, there is some reason to say that these people can just suffer just as much. So my prediction would be that in Britain there will be court cases that will challenge a possible law and say that this is unjust because the chronic patients and, for example, psychiatric patients will have much more suffering, and they are being done injustice.
So do I take it that you believe that this is opening a Pandora's box?
Well, yes and no. What I think is better than in the Netherlands is that Britain seems to go towards assistance in suicide only. And history shows, for example, in American states, that where you have assistance in suicide, the numbers are considerably lower than when it is euthanasia. Again, that means that the doctor does the killing. So I think that would be a good thing. But I think there will be movements toward further liberalization.
Okay.
We have seen the numbers develop from 2,000 to 10,000. So that may be something that you could expect as well.
That was Professor Theo Burr from Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.